Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. This installment of Periodical Radio is about the scholarly journal Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. This is a new name for a journal published since 1963 as Mental Retardation. There's a story behind the name change, a story I'll let my guest tell. The journal is a bi-monthly publication of the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. Each issue contains 3 to 5 research articles written in the style prescribed by the American Psychological Association. Issues also include sections titled Perspectives, Book Reviews, and Trends and Milestones. As is typical with scholarly journals, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities is available both online and in print. My guest is Dr. Stephen Taylor, editor of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and professor at the Center on Human Policy and the School of Education at Syracuse University. Dr. Taylor, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Thanks.
Let's begin with the recent change in the name of the journal and the association. Why the change from mental retardation to intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Well, this has a long history of, debates about the language we use. But the long and short of it is mental retardation has become pejorative. And people use, for example, the word retard as, a generic epithet. And so the name was changed, largely for that reason.
I see. And I don't know very much about this area. What's the distinction between intellectual disabilities and developmental disabilities?
Developmental disability is a broader term that refers to people, who acquire disabilities at a young age, the so-called developmental age. So it can include people with physical disabilities, such as cerebral palsy. Intellectual disabilities, as the name suggests, it refers to people who are slow in learning. It doesn't mean they can't learn, but that learn at a slower rate than other people. Developmental is a broader term. Intellectual is a specific term that refers to people with intellectual disabilities, the people we used to call mentally retarded. But as I said, there's such a long history of language in this field. People were called mental defectives. And before that, they were the feeble-minded. And before that, they were idiots, imbeciles, and morons. And if you follow the history of this field, and this is something, those of us in the field debate all the time, we continue to come up with new professional terminology that, over time becomes negative and stigmatizing. So the shift to intellectual disabilities was long in coming for the what was previously the American Association on Mental Retardation and the journal Mental Retardation, it was really prompted by the objections of many people to have been labeled mentally retarded, and families find that terminology just so offensive today. Is it the language that's stigmatizing, or the broader societal stereotypes, and we'll continue to stereotype people, as long as we devalue them, based on their presumed intellectual ability.
What disciplines are represented in your journal?
It's somewhat unique journal in the sense that it's very interdisciplinary, but I'd have to go back to give you a context for it. What's now the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities was established in the latter part of the 1800s as an organization of superintendents of asylums for idiots. Originally, it was very medically dominated, the association. Then, in the early 1900s, psychology became more prominent. And so, psychologists became involved in the field. More recently, it's become a much broader field. My own background is sociology, not psychology or medicine. We have members of the association and subscribers to the journal who come from a full range of academic disciplines. Some are more clinically oriented, nursing, physical therapy, special education, medicine, psychology. But there's a growing number of people who have backgrounds in law and public policy, relatively recent event given the long history of the field, is that today we have laws that protect the rights of people with disabilities, including intellectual disabilities. You know, we have a right to education. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act. So law attorneys and policymakers are now interested in the field. You know, there's historians who are interested, people with backgrounds in philosophy. As I said, my own background is as a sociologist, and I've tried to encourage, you know, submissions from, you know, people in the social sciences to the journal. And from my vantage point, my interest is not necessarily studying people with intellectual disabilities themselves, but more studying intellectual disabilities as social and cultural phenomenon. And so, for example, public attitudes towards people, you know, the representation of people with various forms of disabilities in popular culture and in the media and in television, movies, and so on and so forth. So it really is a diverse field. And one of the things I've tried to do as editor of the journal, and I've been, you know, doing this for quite a while. In 1993, I started. You know, I've tried to encourage, you know, submissions of manuscripts from people who have new and unique perspectives on the field.
There was a recent perspectives piece in June of 2007 by Robert Persky.
Oh, yes.
He outlined some of the very profound changes over the last century in attitudes toward persons with intellectual disabilities.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you tell us a little more about those attitudes and how they've changed? You've alluded to them, but could you talk a little bit more about the changes over the century?
You know, the history of the field, you know, it has changed rapidly. And, you know, and I'll go back to the, yeah, quite a while, to, you know, to the mid 1800s was really when the field developed. You know, before that time, you know, people with various disabilities were kind of lumped in together. I mean, there weren't distinctions between people we would call intellectually disabled and people today we would call or characterize as having psychiatric disabilities. Back then, and the terminology is, you know, it is offensive, you know, but back then idiots and the insane were kind of mixed up together, okay? So but anyway, you know, back in the mid-1800s, you know, distinctions started to be made between, you know, different disability groups, and the first efforts actually were professional efforts were mainly educational in nature, and, you know, it was an optimistic period in the mid-1800s. By the latter part of the 1800s, early 1900s, societal attitudes changed radically, and the emphasis shifted from educating people to, quite frankly, social control. And there was, you know, a whole social movement that's somewhat, you know, well known today, the eugenics movement, that was supposedly that was designed to prevent what was seen as the transmission of defective genes. I mean, the theories, you know, at the time were that we had inferior people who were procreating, spreading their genes, and all kinds of disabilities were kind of associated in that, and that then, especially, you know, what was called feeble-mindedness at the time was associated with crime and vice and all kinds of social ills. And it's a long and complex history, but you know, it reflects to some extent, you know, waves of immigration in the latter part of the 1800s, early 1900s. You know, the fact we had people coming to this country who did not share the basic Anglo-Saxon culture. They did not speak English, and they were viewed as inferior. And literally, there was a movement to give immigrants, you know, IQ tests that were just being developed to try to sort out people who would be bringing these supposed defective genes into the country. I mean, the irony of it. Sometimes, you know, these tests were given for people who they were given in English for people who didn't speak English. So, and you know, there was an element of racism in all of this, in the sense of either racism or discrimination against certain ethnic groups. You know, immigrants in the latter part of the 1800s, early 1900s. Increasingly, we're coming from southern and eastern Europe, not western Europe, which, you know, was a dominant ethnic group in America. So, there was a lot of concern, and in some cases, bordering on hysteria about, you know, the defective people coming into the country. The response was to develop a series of social control measures where people were institutionalized, often, you know, in the name of doing something for them. The reality was that it was to, you know, keep them off the streets, keep them out of the community. So we developed the institutions. You know, there were a series of involuntary sterilization laws passed. And, you know, the figures aren't precise, but, you know, something like, you know, 27,000 people with intellectual disabilities were involuntarily sterilized to keep them from procreating. There were restrictive marriage laws. You know, certain categories of people, both ethnically and based on disability, were excluded from being able to immigrate into states. So we went through this very, very dark period of history that,
Well, then what then caused the shift away from sort of a eugenics model to a more compassionate model?
Well, what really killed eugenics in this country, it rears its ugly head every once in a while. Nazi Germany, you know, Nazi Germany, the first people who were murdered in Nazi Germany and on whom the mass extermination techniques were perfected were people in mental institutions, both people with intellectual and psychiatric disabilities. Hundreds of thousands of them were killed in Nazi Germany. I think there was such revulsion to, you know, what happened in Nazi Germany and what happened to Jewish people, Gypsies, so on and so forth, that, you know, a lot of these eugenics theories were just utterly discredited because of the Nazis. And you know, when the Nazis started killing people in institutions, as I said, they perfected the gas chamber. You know, they would send people supposedly into showers and then gas them to death. The Germans behind that effort cited American literature, you know, from earlier in the 1900s to justify that. So that was a bit of a turning point. The other critical events that happened, because of the assumption that feeble-mindedness, mental deficiency, yeah, mental retardation, whatever, because of the assumption that it was always hereditary, you know, family member, it was stigmatizing to be a family member. That started to change in the late 50s and continued throughout the 50s into the 60s. So you had family members coming out, like, you know, Pearl Buck was a very well-known author at the time. You know, I happened to have a daughter with mental retardation, and she wrote about that. Then, you know, in the early 60s, the Kennedy family, you know, JFK's sister happened to have, you know, what was called mental retardation, and the Kennedy family, you know, were public about that and addressed the issue of mental retardation. And you know, after that, you know, family members then could, parents and other family members could come out publicly and start advocating for their sons and daughters. And then most recently, I mean, there's a whole movement of people with intellectual disabilities who are so-called self-advocates. That they've organized groups to change public policies. You know, today, today's, things aren't perfect. I mean, there's growing acceptance, and at least, occasionally in TV programs, movies, popular culture, you'll see people with Down syndrome, for example. Increasingly, it's no big deal. People with all forms of disabilities are much more visible in society today. You know, we still have a lot of negative public attitudes to overcome. I mean, the belief that, if you have an intellectual disability, and I use that term because it's less offensive, there will come a point in time where that is pejorative. I mean, that's what we've learned over history. You see people with mental retardation, they're working, they hold jobs, they're living in the community, they're no longer predominantly just put away in institutions. We've come a long way. We have a lot further to come. So anyway, when it goes back to the journal, one of the things I've tried to do as a journal editor, if you've seen the journal, there will be research articles in there. But I created this whole section of the journal that is called Perspectives, where I want thoughtful commentaries from, thoughtful people. I think we can learn a lot, not just through traditional research, but reflecting on where we've been and where we're going. So that's where the Persky article comes in. And, Bob Persky is somebody I've known for years. He's been very active in the field. He actually has a background in religion, and that's how he got involved in the field as a chaplain at an institution, way back in the 60s. Now he's become a strong advocate for the rights of people with intellectual disabilities. And he's now a professional writer. I think writers, people of backgrounds in the humanities, can contribute. The field historically, in my opinion, was just too narrowly dominated by clinical, medical, psychological perspectives, and we have to look at intellectual disability as a broader social, cultural phenomenon. In the same way, the analogy, I mean, and people don't always get the analogy. Today, we study race, ethnicity, gender today in ways very different from how those issues were studied before.
I wanted to ask you, the association also publishes the American Journal on Mental Retardation.
Yes.
I think that addresses the point. Why have two journals for the one association?
Historically, two things. If you read AJ, American Journal of Mental Retardation, and it still has that name, by the way, which is interesting. It's much more almost exclusively oriented to medicine and psychology and much more basic kind of research. Mental retardation, when it was founded first in 63, was designed to be a more applied journal. Journal that, published research, but more practical kind of research and applied research that would be of value to people in the field. And of course, my opinion is we need all kinds of research, and sometimes we learn things from basic medical research, but we all know, also need research that's more relevant to the issues of today. And as I said, since I became editor in the early 90s, I've kind of broadened that applied mission to really encourage thoughtful commentaries and essays on the field. So I've kind of gone from an applied research focus. It still has that, but it's broadened in terms of the emphasis of the journal.
I have a question about the actual production of your journal. It's done in conjunction with Allen Press. which I'm familiar with, but I'm sure our listeners are not. Can you describe for our listeners what Allen Press is and does, and how their services help you publish the journal?
I'll explain what I know. Yeah, I mean the way the association works and the journal works is, you know, my job is to be editor, which means, you know, I coordinate the review process. I make final editorial decisions on manuscripts as to whether they're accepted for publication or not. After that, the production process has always been in the hands of the central office of the American Association on Mental Retardation, now American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, which I'm glad, you know, I have my hands full just doing the editorial process, working with authors, helping them to strengthen their articles. So, you know, it's always been handled. The process has always, publication process has always been handled by the association. And, you know, now they've contracted with Allen Press to handle the production of the journal. Now, where it has an impact on me as an editor is that we've moved to a web-based submission system through Allen Press. And, you know, when I started in the old way of doing this, you know, a manuscript would be mailed to me. And, you know, as an editor, you know, the first question I have and the first decision I have to make is, you know, what kinds of people would be good to review this manuscript? And, you know, since it's an interdisciplinary journal, you know, I make sure that I have reviewers who have relevant expertise. So I do publish historical pieces. You know, I want people with backgrounds in history to review those, or sociology, or law and public policy, or psychology, whatever it is. I want reviewers from those fields to evaluate the articles. So anyway, once I select the reviewers, then the manuscripts are sent out in the mail. Then sometime later, reviews are mailed back. I integrate the reviewers' recommendations, mail a decision letter. And also, I mean, the other thing about the publication process is manuscripts are almost never accepted as is. Yeah, I mean, the role of an editor is to work with authors to make their manuscripts stronger, if they're acceptable to begin with. So anyway, that was the old system. Right now, through Allen Press, and they have this web-based system called Allen Track, reviewers or authors submit via the web, then, you know, I get a notice that the manuscript has been received, and then, you know, I select the reviewers, and they're immediately sent the manuscript via email, and, you know, they're automatic reminders to reviewers saying, well, you know, your review is late, and, you know, we need your review. And, you know, when the manuscript goes out to them, they have the opportunity to decline if they're too busy. But their reviews are submitted electronically. Then once I have all of the reviews in, typically three, sometimes I'll decide on two if a third reviewer has never submitted something. But my decision letter is sent electronically. What it means from my vantage point as an editor is, you know, it cuts several weeks off of the decision-making process, and it's very efficient because I'm not relying now on the mail, and I found X percentage of mail never gets through. So you know, electronic system is much more efficient.
Dr. Taylor, what do you enjoy best about the job of editing the journal?
Two things. One is And you know, the, I mean, the association gave me the opportunity when I became editor. You know, I wanted to introduce new features, like the perspective section, and like the article by Bob Persky. I mean, you mentioned it, and you know, you don't have to answer this, but my guess, even though you're not in the field, you could read Bob's article and basically understand what he was talking about. I mean, you know, I wanted people in the field to be exposed. Bob Persky, as I say, he's been in the field forever. He never published in any of the professional journals, I mean, because his writing wasn't suitable. I mean, it wasn't the typical research writing. And again, I have nothing against researchers. I am one. But you know, I wanted to expose readers to different points of view from thoughtful, critical thinkers. So I did that, introduced you know, some other features. And you know, I've enjoyed doing that. The other thing, quite frankly, I think most editors I know, one of the most fulfilling aspects is especially working with young authors. You know, like, I mean, the person who just got her or his PhD, for example. And now, you know, they did the dissertation, and now they want to publish journal articles. Yeah, well, one of the things, very often in graduate school, you know, you're taught to write papers in a certain way or to write a dissertation or thesis. You're really not taught how to, you know, take, you know, a lot of information and boil it down into a journal article, or they don't know how to frame an article. You know, it's fulfilling, I think, for most editors. Yeah, I mean, to work with somebody who has something important to say, but they don't know, they haven't figured out how to say it. So, you know, working with authors, going through multiple revisions and helping them to frame their articles, to tighten their reasoning, to, yes, apply, you know, details that the readers will want to know. And the other thing, you know, since, you know, as I said, the journal has always been designed to be applied. You know, my question always is, when I read an article or when something comes in, is who cares about this? Who's going to read it? And very often, you know, new authors, as I said, they have something to say, but they can't explain to readers why, you know, why readers should be interested in it. So, yeah, I think that's one of the most fulfilling parts of being an editor is, you know, feeling like you have an impact and you've helped somebody contribute to, yeah, to our knowledge or our understanding, and you know, it's their work, it's their ideas, but they just need help shaping it.
Well, Dr. Taylor, thank you very much for being my guest here on Periodical Radio. Our half hour is already done,
good,
believe it or not.
Okay, fine.
Thank you very much.
Sure, bye.
Information about intellectual and developmental disabilities, including how to subscribe, is online at www.aaidd.org. Thank you for listening to this installment of Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.